All right, welcome everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started and call this meeting to order, and we will start with the Pledge of Allegiance. Please join me.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Next on the agenda are recognitions, and we'll turn the time over to Dr. Iser.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had to look to make sure that Nikki Chung-Gao was sitting over there, and I'll ask you to answer that. I'm not quite sure when this award started, but this is the second year in a row, well, since I've been here for almost 2 years now, that we've been able to honor you all and the immunization team for the Silver Syringe Award. So let me read this, please. The Southern Nevada Health District Immunization Clinic was recently nominated for the Silver Syringe Awards and chosen to receive the Outstanding Community Partner Award that recognizes a community organization that demonstrates exceptional dedication to immunizations and furthering the mission of Immunize Nevada through collaboration and partnership. The Silver Syringe Award recognizes immunization champions who exemplify best practices, high rates, and strong partnerships in their clinics and everyday practices throughout the state of Nevada. This prestigious award highlights the best of the best and takes the time to honor the winners at a formal sit-down dinner event, which was held on April 24th at the Springs Preserve right across the street. The SNHD Immunization Clinic was also recognized by Senators Heller and Reed as outstanding community partners and for their commitment to the health and well-being of individuals and families throughout the Southern Nevada Health District. Congratulations to Bonnie Sorensen, who's the Director of Clinics and Nursing Services, Rick Seachy, Community Health Nurse Manager, Miki Chung-Dao, Senior Community Health Nurse, and the entire Southern Nevada Health District Immunization Clinic staff. And there are actually three things in my hand. One is the actual Silver Syringe Award itself. May I hand this to you? The second is the proclamation from United States Senator Dean Heller, and the third from Senator Reed. And why don't you move up here and we'll take a picture with.
Thank you for recognizing the immunization program. Just briefly, thank some of our partners, Hep B Free Nevada, United Way of Southern Nevada, for helping us do a lot of these projects in the community. Thank you, Bonnie Sorensen and Dr. Iser.
And again, thank the group for all the work that they do day in and day out. My guess is that some of you sitting at the front table get your immunizations here. If you don't, I can guarantee you that standing next to me is the person I would have do any immunization for me anytime, anywhere.
It doesn't involve needles, right?
And just an announcement that because of logistical reasons, we won't be doing the badging ceremony today. We'll plan to do that next month.
Thank you. I don't think anybody would argue that that's one of the most important programs that we have here at the Health District, and we really appreciate all the hard work you do on that. We will move to our first public comment period, which is public comments on items on the agenda. Anyone wishing to speak at this time? Okay, seeing none, we'll move to adoption of today's agenda.
So moved.
We have a motion.
Second.
And a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? And that motion carries. And then we'll move to the consent agenda. Any changes or discussion?
Motion to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? And that motion carries also. Next are the public hearing action items, Roman numeral 4. And we have number 1, consider adopt a variance request to operate a public bathing place not in compliance with Nevada Administrative Code 444.134.1 and 444.166.1, Topgolf International.
Good morning. Topgolf International is petitioning for a variance for 2 pools to be constructed with less than 90% unobstructed deck perimeter and an overflow gutter trough edge that extends for approximately 50% of the perimeter in lieu of continuous gutter. Representing Topgolf today, representing the owner, is Dominic Crespo. Come up, Dominic. Desmond Stevens, engineer of record. Clemente Shikoria, I'm sorry, YWS Architects, and Jill Rubin, project manager. I'm going to turn over the rest of the description of the variance to Jeremy Harper, who is our pool supervisor.
So Nevada Administrative Code NAC 444-134, subsection 1, states that a clear unobstructed deck must be provided around the entire perimeter of a pool. In no case may the width of the pool deck be less than 4 feet. Deck may be obstructed for a distance equal to not more than 10% of the perimeter of the pool. And NAC 444-166.1 states in part that the overflow gutter around any pool must be continuous around the pool except at stairs or recess ladders. Staff is of the opinion that there exist circumstances which satisfy the requirements for a variance and that granting of this variance will not be detrimental or pose unreasonable danger to public health and safety if the following conditions are included. Therefore, staff recommends the approval of the variance in accordance with the outlined conditions. These conditions are: the petitioner agrees to maintain a walkway area around the pools accessible and free from obstruction. The petitioner will maintain lifeguard coverage at both bodies of water during all hours of operation. Additional lifeguards may be required by the health authority due to placement and any obstructions present for optimal bathing surveillance. Additional wall inlets to be provided at areas without continuous skimming as authorized by the health authority. The petitioner agrees to adhere to all other applicable requirements of public bathing places, public spas regulations, NAC 444. The petitioner agrees to provide steps to exit the pool with required tread heights on the interior and exterior tread heights on the exterior of the pools as deemed necessary by the health authority. The petitioner agrees to operate the facility as approved by the health authority and does not intend to operate the facility as a high occupancy or party pool facility and shall request approval in writing to the health authority prior to any modifications to the approved plan and or facility. Failure of the petitioner to prevent public health and safety issues as determined by the health authority will result in the voiding of this variance. Pertinent design changes that deviate from the plans proposed during the initial review of the variance may void the variance, and this variance is automatically terminated without further notice upon the closing of any sale transaction involving the subject property or upon petitioner leasing or assigning operation of these public bathing spas pools to any other person or entity.
Thank you. Any questions or comments from the board?
I have a question.
Chris.
Thank you. Just on Koval, where exactly are you located at the pool?
Dominic Crespo, the director of construction for Topgolf. We're located basically on the corner of Koval and Harmon, basically where
Spencer
the old amusement park
okay.
used to be.
I was thinking it was about Mary Beth's or mine because we split right there at Harmon. So, and the issue about potential sale, then this goes away. What is that in regards to the staff?
Oh, that standard language you use on all variances.
Right? Okay.
Changes owners.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Osgood?
I just want to know, you guys agree with all this?
Yes, sir.
Okay, sir.
Mary Beth.
This is a really great project. It's exciting and nice to see these conditions and that we can work with it. It's another example of how
Las Vegas has unique pools, and we have to be flexible with those. I would move to accept.
Second.
Okay. We've got a motion and a second, but we've got more comments, and then we have to put it to the public.
Just a quick question that's maybe a little more technical. I noticed your fourth level floor was, or pool, excuse me, was 3 feet 6 inches deep. Is that uniform across that?
No, it's not uniform. I'm Desmond Stevens, the engineer of record. It actually has a very shallow tapering slope to subscribe to Chapter 444 requirement for pools. It increases in depth by just an inch, but it is a positive slope to drains from 3'5" to 3'6".
What's the difference between that and a spa? Because I thought it became a spa when it's at that level.
A spa has a maximum depth of 3'6" and can
was
actually
okay.
have a flat
I thought
bottom.
It was 4.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any other discussion? So this is a public hearing. I'll invite the public to speak if anyone would wish to. All right, seeing none, then we'll bring it back to the board. Do I have a motion?
Second.
That's how we do. That's right. Motion and a second. So we're ready for a vote. Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And that motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're moving on to Roman numeral 5, sub 1, review, discuss community health assessment.
And if I may introduce this entire item, these are things that we thought would be very interesting to you as we make our progression. You may recall that for accreditation that we have to do 3 major prerequisites. The community health assessment, which Dr. Williams will go over with you first, is a part of that. We are now just getting ready to transition into the phase of the community health improvement plan, which uses the data from the community health assessment to work with community partners and the public to develop a community health improvement plan that isn't all up to us to accomplish, but is up to us with our partners to try to accomplish. And for us, it would be within our regulatory or our overall authority and our budget, and with our partners to work with them. The final phase for that is to redo our strategic plan. So it's the CHA, the CHIP, and the strategic plan that are really the prerequisites for accreditation. And we hope to, again, have all those done by, I think it's November. Andy? By November, so that we meet our one-year deadline from our first application. The first part of this three-part presentation is really just related to the CHA, the CHIP, and the strategic plan. Dr. Williams will discuss the CHA.
Okay, good morning. And we have about 15 minutes to cover all this. There's a lot of material to cover, so I apologize in advance. We're both going to read some notes so we don't miss anything. Yeah, I'm sorry. In order to see up close and read my notes, I can't really see the screen that well. Hopefully I won't get off here. But anyway, I'd like to start by giving you the context in which the current community health assessment, which we'll refer to as the CHA, has been developed, and that requires going back to 2011. SNHD was still headquartered at 625 Shadow Lane at that time and began pursuing public health accreditation. We applied for and received a small grant to start the process. One of the products required, as you know, for public health accreditation is the CHA, which is today's topic. The development of a CHA is intended to be a collaborative process, and a number of models exist that have been proven, and the mobilizing action through planning and partnerships, or MAP, as the model that was selected back in 2011. And you learned about the MAP process in an accreditation presentation previously. I will just reiterate that MAP's a community-driven strategic planning process for improving community health, and the MAP process results in 4 assessments that together comprise the CHA. The community health status assessment, which is a report of objective data representing the health of Clark County residents, is one of them. The local public health system assessment's another. As is the community themes and strengths, and then the fourth one is the forces of change. And as most of you are already aware, SNHD experienced some disruption of operations in 2012 following the closure of the Shadow Lane campus and our move here to Valley View, and we got a new health officer and further MAP activities And community partner with community partners, and the compilation of the four map elements into the CHA were put on hold. However, we had made some accomplishments by that point, and three of the map assessments that comprised the CHA were completed. And the community health status assessment, again, that's the data report, was drafted but not finalized or published, although the draft copy was shared with our grantor. Last year, however, it was given a little bit of fine-tuning and posted on the SNHD website, although it had not been updated with newer data at that time. So in 2014, SNHD restarted the process of public health accreditation and the reconvening of community partners to participate in the MAP process. A steering committee was formed consisting of various members of the public health community. At that time, it was decided not to update two of the MAP assessments that had been done in 2012, as they were deemed to be still relevant. The forces of change assessment, which is the a third one, was recently updated to take into account the most current forces affecting our community's health. And we also began revising that 2012 community health status assessment with newer data. We also began rethinking which data to include. And a lot has changed since 2011 when accreditation was just being introduced. And now there's actually a number of already accredited public health agencies from whom we can review their reports and borrow some ideas. As you know, public health is very good about sharing things, and we are actually learning quite a bit from these other reports. And that's given us the opportunity to do a bit more of a major revision. So we're going to be continuing that. The report that you've seen now is still officially a draft, and will continue to be a draft until we are ready to submit it to the accreditation board, because we really have opportunities to make some major improvements to that report between now and then. So although the CHA is still in draft form, we believe it contains most of the data that will comprise its final version that will be published later this year. The steering committee reviewed the draft and worked together to identify seven proposed priority areas affecting the health of Southern Nevada community. And these priorities are going to be shared with the community partners at the first Community Health Improvement Plan, or CHIP, team meeting, which is scheduled for June 18th, for their consideration in developing the CHIP. The priority issues were selected using the following criteria. Each of them was noted to have been deemed as important in more than one of the MAP assessments. And, of course, importance is sort of a subjective term, but the committee took into consideration things like the numbers of people affected by the issue, personal cost or cost to society, effect on length or quality of life, feasibility of an intervention, and then, of course, how Southern Nevada fares compared with national averages, benchmarks, and targets. And the top seven priorities that the steering committee is proposing to the CHIP committee for consideration are chronic disease, and this is based on these accounting for the top causes of death and disability in Clark County and nationally. Injury, particularly suicide and drug poisoning, which are determined to be a particular concern in Clark County. Maternal and child health, because for certain measures, Clark County and Nevada overall are well below the national averages or haven't met the national targets. Infectious disease, particularly pneumonia and influenza, because this category of illness ranks higher in Nevada than elsewhere for cause of death, and the intervention is a pretty simple one, which is vaccination. And then there are three issues that are related to the support for health in general, which are public health policy and funding, access to health care, and quality and continuity of health care. And please note that these issues aren't listed in any particular order of priority, just listed in a random order here. And at this point, it's also worth mentioning that these are community-wide priorities. And although SNHD's strategic plan, which will be developed, as Dr. Iser mentioned, as part of the accreditation process, is likely to be highly focused on the issues identified as community-wide priorities, it's also likely that our strategic plan will include some agency-specific priorities that are likely to include things like tuberculosis, sexually transmitted, and HIV/AIDS. And, of course, anything that's not on the list of top priorities doesn't mean that it's not important. So it was very hard for the committee to narrow these things down. And they have the opportunity to make some changes as well. But that's where we're starting anyway. In addition to the seven priorities that I just showed you, the steering committee also noted three overarching concerns that they felt should be taken into consideration regardless of the priority topic. Those include health equity, disparities in health, improving data sources, monitoring and assessment of health issues, and the concept of complete communities or built environment. And when the CHIP community partners meet, they'll assess each priority, further narrowing or possibly otherwise adjusting the list.
Nancy, if I can just make sure that the board understands these concepts. If you have any questions, I think Nancy wouldn't mind having questions as she goes through these slides.
Sure. Okay. Anyway, so for the remainder of the presentation, Dr. Ying Zhang is going to present the findings from the community health status assessment. And again, that's the data-focused assessment that specifically relate to the proposed community health priority issues.
Good morning. I will continue highlighting the priority issues that we identified from community health status assessment. In 2013, when the most recent data is available, the top 10 leading causes of death in the United States were, in rank order, heart disease, cancer, chronic lower respiratory disease, unintentional injury, stroke, Alzheimer's disease, diabetes, influenza, pneumonia, nephritis, and suicide. For the chart, we look at 10 years of Clark County mortality data for each of these diseases. For 5 out of the 10 diseases, Clark County had higher age-adjusted death rate than the U.S. These 5 diseases are presented in this slide. Among them, heart disease, chronic lower respiratory disease, and kidney disease fell under chronic disease. One of the priorities identified, influenza pneumonia was another priority listed in an early slide, and same for suicide. Next, we'll talk about more detail about how they were chosen as priorities. Chronic disease impacts more people in our community than any other disease categories. This slide shows 10 years of age-adjusted death rates of the 10 leading causes of death in Clark County. Heart disease and cancer are the number 1 and 2 killers of Clark County residents. They consistently outnumbered other diseases by a very large margin over years. Together with other chronic diseases on the list, they contributed to about 2/3 of total deaths among Clark County residents each year.
Could I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Oh, age adjusted.
It's a method that can make the death rates comparable.
Because here in Clark County, we have a lot of, I'm
younger,
assuming places like
population.
Florida, older population, and there are retirement communities and things like that. Arizona, you might have that. So you've adjusted for that because some of these heart disease,
correct,
diabetes, all these things.
Yes, exactly. So
we've adjusted, and we're still higher.
So that we are comparable with other communities in the country.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what the table is.
So altogether, chronic disease contribute to about 2/3 of the total deaths among our residents each year. The lower portion of the chart is a little crowded, and we'll take a closer look at them in the next slide.
Excuse me, I actually have a quick question. I know you're talking about chronic disease, but how does unintentional injuries fit into chronic disease? Because that's
an injury. They are another category.
Okay.
But we are just showing the top 10 leading causes of death in this slide.
Okay, I thought this was the chart that showed all the chronic diseases.
We are highlighting chronic disease,
okay,
but it's not all about chronic disease. This slide presents the lower portion of the previous slide in a different scale. Same as the previous slide, the legend on the right lists the diseases in the order of their national rank. As we just mentioned, for some of the diseases, Clark County has higher than average death rates. Therefore, the ranks of those diseases in Clark County are different from those in the U.S. In many years, unintentional injury surpassed stroke and became the fourth leading cause of death in Clark County. Influenza pneumonia ranked number 8 in the nation, but in Clark County, it's in number 6 or 7, depends on which year we look at, leading cause of death. Similarly, suicide was the 10th leading cause of death nationally. However, in Clark County, suicide death rates have overtaken Alzheimer's disease and diabetes since 2006, and by 2012, it became number 7 leading cause of death in Clark County. In fact, our suicide death rate has consistently been 1.5 times as high as the U.S., which leads us to the next priority, injury. Suicide and drug poisonings are the two leading causes of premature mortality for Southern Nevada. Both of them are also associated with mental health and substance use and abuse. Suicide was chosen as a priority not only because its death toll is high in Clark County, but also it affects some groups in our community that are usually overlooked. In this slide, we see whites are about twice as likely to die from suicide as the other race ethnicity groups, which is different from many other diseases where minority groups are usually at higher risk. Suicide also affects male and the middle-aged people more than their counterparts, both of which are traditionally thought as less vulnerable groups and have limited prevention attention. Drug poisoning was one of the priority areas in the Healthy People 2020 objective. The CDC has extensively documented the dramatic rise in fatal poisonings and the role of pharmaceutical drug overdoses as a major cause of this epidemic. Currently, we don't have much data available on this issue, which reflects one of the overarching concerns that Dr. Williams presented earlier, improving data sources. But with the limited data we have now, opioid analgesics were involved in more drug poisoning deaths in Clark County than in the nation. Of the 1,249 drug poisoning deaths in 2010-12, 65% involved prescription opioids. In comparison, 41% of drug poisoning deaths nationwide involved opioid analgesics. As well, nearly 3 out of 4 pharmaceutical overdoses in the nation involve opioid, whereas the comparable rates were 81% in Clark County. Deaths attributed to opioid often involve other drugs. The concomitant use of opioid analgesics with sedatives such as those in benzodiazepine family greatly increases the risk for overdose. In 2010 to 2012, 41% of opioid poisoning deaths also involved benzodiazepines, compared to 22% in 2007 to 2009, and a national rate of 31%. Preterm birth and low birth weight are the number 2 killer of the infants less than 1 year old in Clark County, ranked right after congenital anomalies. From 2004 to 2013, 146 infants in Clark County died from preterm birth and or low birth weight. For these two measures, even though we have seen declining trend over years, Clark County still haven't reached Healthy People 2020 target. Healthy People 2020 targets at 11.4% for preterm birth and 7.8% low birth weight, while the numbers for Clark County were 14.4% and 8.3% respectively. Moreover, we are still seeing disparities among different race ethnicity groups. Preterm birth rate is much higher among black mothers compared with other racial ethnic groups. And the same trends hold for low birth weight.
What was the average age of the mothers then? Were they younger?
You mean for the black population?
Yes.
Yes.
You don't have that.
Yes.
Maybe you can get that. I'd just be curious to see if it's more teen.
Yeah. For teen births, teen mothers, they're more teen birth rates are higher among black population than white population.
Okay, and then that translated into more preemies? Is that what you were just... I'm trying to understand the chart that's there. The mother's rate.
It's a risk factor, but it doesn't necessarily mean it causes preterm birth.
Okay. Okay. All right, thank you.
May I? Yes. I didn't want to interrupt. May I make a suggestion? It may make the tables when you finalize them a little too crowded, but if you could give an end of at least Clark County, what the numbers were in Clark County as an N, so we knew whether we had significant populations or not. That might be helpful on each of these tables. As I went through the tables, I was keep getting curious what the N was.
Okay.
Having prepared this kinds of stuff for many years.
Thanks.
Influenza and pneumonia are leading causes of death in Clark County. The two diseases are highly associated, as pneumonia is often a complication of influenza. Influenza pneumonia vaccination are especially recommended for persons most at risk, including the very young, the elderly, and the immunocompromised. We saw higher death toll in Clark County that was attributed to influenza pneumonia than in the U.S., which makes it the number 7 leading cause of death. And in the for the U.S., it's a number 9 or 8. For both influenza and pneumonia immunizations, we still have a long way to go to reach either the U.S. average or the healthy people target. The healthy people target is the solid blue line on the top, and the two rates for U.S. are the dotted lines, and the two solid lines at the bottom are Clark County immunization rates. So those are all about the disease statistics, and we also have other cross-cutting priority issues identified in our assessment, policy and funding related to public health, access to care, quality and continuity of care. Public health agencies focus on the health of communities. Their efforts complement clinical medicine in protecting the health of community residents. Funding of public health agencies is one measure of their potential for positively influencing health. The main external sources of revenue for local health departments are CDC, HRSA, and state governments. Per capita public health funding from these three sources varies widely by state across the U.S. For fiscal year 2013, Nevada per capita public funding was $39, which was at bottom of the nation, and the range for the funding in the U.S. was $39 to $224. Medical costs in the United States are extremely high, so people without health insurance may not be able to afford medical treatment or prescription drugs. They are also less likely to get routine checkups and screenings. So if they do become ill, they will not seek treatment until the condition is more advanced and therefore more difficult and costly to treat. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, in 2013, 27.9% of Southern Nevada's residents under age 65 had no health insurance, while 15.3% under age 18 had no insurance. The Healthy People 2020 national health target is to increase the proportion of people with health insurance to 100%. Disparities in health and healthcare in the United States have been a long-standing challenge, resulting in some groups receiving less and lower quality healthcare than others and experiencing poor health outcomes. Neighborhoods with low health insurance rates often have fewer providers, hospital beds, and emergency resources than areas with higher rates. Even the insured have more difficulty getting care in these areas. Hispanics and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islanders experience the lowest percentage of adults with health insurance. Only about 58% of Latino Hispanic adults report having health insurance, compared to 79% of non-Hispanic whites. And that's about the data part. And I'm ready to take questions. If there's any more.
Yes, Doug.
The $39 per capita is, it's really sad that we're last in the country. What can we do to boost that? I mean, what do we need to look at? Who do we need to go beat up?
I can add one thing to that. I guess there are the three components of it. There's CDC funding, HRSA funding, and state funding, and it's actually the state funding that makes us the lowest So I guess your state legislators.
Legislature, here we come.
We've got about 5 days.
And Southwest flies several times. We're good.
We've discussed this, I think, several times since I've been here, and I know, Mr. Beers, I've given you some of the data to help support this, that indeed it's the state. It's the fact that Nevada sits on two legs of a three-legged stool without a personal income tax that most states have. And even though some of the other tax rates are a little bit higher than in surrounding states that have those three legs, it doesn't make up for the personal income tax. Do I want to pay personal income tax? Well, probably not, but I'd be willing to do it personally if we could see better services, including education, including health, including Medicaid funding, including public health funding, but I'm one person. We did not lobby for this except for the one issue related to, I think it was SB 189, which is the EMS and trauma funding, which if we had gotten that through the legislature would have freed up a whole lot of $8010 dollars, but we were unable to get it through the legislature despite Senator Woodhouse's valiant efforts to do so. If we're lucky, we may get enough money through that to fund the state to develop a trauma registry that by law they're supposed to have already. But we that's the only one that I recall, and I'll look to Andy and to Jennifer. I think that's the only one related to any funding that we tried to develop. So I do think that we ought to work as a group over the interim and to see what we can do to increase some of that funding from the state level. And we virtually get nothing from the state. The pieces that we get from the state are those that are transmitted from those federal agencies to the state and then given partially to us.
Question? Yes. Several years ago, we talked about at least changing the distribution so that those federal dollars came directly to us. What was the status or what?
We're still working on that. So what we would like to be able to do is to apply directly to these federal agencies for more of the grants. Currently, we're unable to do that, but we're looking at options on how we can find a way to do that.
Regulatory prohibitions, or is it just?
It's just part of it is the way that things function. CDC functions by giving grants to states on the average. For the maternal child health program, which comes from HRSA to the state, that's also it's a block grant, doesn't come down to the locals. Where we can apply for directly for grants is family planning, which is neither one of those two agencies. The PITCH grant that came out of CDC, we were able to apply for, and we're actually applying for an HIV grant right now, Dr. Lockett, that should go in maybe this week that we did work with the state on, and then the state said they agreed with us that we can apply directly. So that grant should go in either late this week or very early next week. That's if we get all of that, that's right. Another $2.1
million.
But a lot of that goes out to our partners,
exactly.
Like with the PITCH grant.
It's redistributed in the long run. So
right, but it's still good for the community as a whole if we get those grants and distribute
them. Well, I noticed that in one of the staff reports that you had a meeting with Congresswoman Titus's office, staff
That's correct.
Office. Is there anything federally that you're working on to try to make some tweaks or changes? Because
I mean,
county is larger, really, than the state budget. Overall.
I know. Can I just simply answer yes without going into detail?
Absolutely. I understand
yes,
how
I
that
am.
Has to work. Okay. And then on the – is it just a lack of acknowledgement on the state level, or is it because we just don't fund them either, and so there's been that problem?
Well, you know, I was in Washoe County for almost right. 2 years before coming here, and I can say that the local health authorities, especially Washoe County and Clark County, don't feel that we get our fair share mm-hmm. of the funds that come into the state. You and I have had that discussion. I think I probably have had with most of you. And so we would like to work with the state to better distribute those funds, keep fewer at the state, provide more to both Washoe County and us. And so that's what we're trying to do as well. And I think we've got discussions coming up on the FEP grant. Or have just recently had discussions.
Maybe after session we should look at the chair and some of the members of the board, possibly some of our doctor side, to maybe meet with the Health and Human Services members from the Assembly and the Senate to start educating them. Because if you wait till it's in the middle of session, you're not going to get any place. I mean, Bob could probably advise you on that part of it, too. But part of it's the education part of knowing how how much gets peeled off, bless you, before it goes to local jurisdictions would be something to help that maybe they could do. They don't see it as a tax increase. I mean, personally, personal income tax, no problem, but it's a constitutional issue, so we'd all be gone by the time anything was acted on that.
Right, and some of the grants that we get come to the state takes off its indirect, and then it doesn't allow us to take off much, if any, indirect. So that's one of the things, as you know, we've been working since the year and a half I've been here, is trying to find ways to cover the indirect through other means than as real indirect. Plus, in most cases, the indirect that we're allowed to charge anyway is only 8 to 10%, and our indirect is 22-25% probably. I think that's the latest that we had. So we're trying to find ways to cover that, because otherwise we just don't have the $80-$10 to go around to wherever they're needed. Thank you for the comment. I hope I didn't overstep my bounds in trying to respond to you in terms of being too political.
Oh, no, not at all.
Good.
There is no such thing.
Good.
Yes.
Maybe I ought to make my question after the meeting, because I wanted to say, one is, I think your report is outstanding.
Thank you.
Yeah. And you've hit a lot of areas that I personally have dealt with for 40 years, and we still have all of those problems. I do have a specific question, which you may or may not know the answer to, and that is that I know in the 70s and 80s, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah set up what they called at the time group purchasing agreements by the state for immunizations that was able to be distributed to the private sector, providing the private sector reported their immunizations and what they gave and everything else. Is that still the case here? Or are you people, is that group purchasing agreement no longer going on?
Basically, the CDC has taken that over for well over a decade now. The CDC has had a program called Vaccines for Children, which is part of a larger program, but it allows individual providers as well as health districts and others and community health centers, for example, to get the vaccines at low or no cost as long as they're providing them to children who are in a certain age range and a certain income level. So we all participate in that. And, in fact, I believe, and I'll look to, if Rick's still here, and certainly to Bonnie, to make sure that we oversee that process here in Clark County to make sure that all of those providers are doing what they should be doing with those funds. Okay. That's what happens in every
county. That's a significant change from what we did in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, where the county health district, basically the state health district, did a group purchase and distributed that for nothing to every population, to all the populations, to make sure we had a herd immunity, correct?
We get the drop shipment.
But it doesn't happen anymore. Okay.
For this program, we get drop shipment to our various clinical sites directly.
There's an economic indicator, and there's a variable that you can't give it to the regular
The
population that isn't economically handicapped.
Right, and for the population that has insurance is supposed to cover it.
I'm with you. Okay.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Any other questions I was going to ask? And I'm sorry I took over your job.
I got a question.
Yes.
Excellent report, and thank you very much. My concern is about the opioid overdoses, and what can the health district do to help decrease the prescriptions for non-terminal chronic pain that seems to be at the root of a lot of these overdoses?
I don't suppose Mike Bernstein's here, is he? The health district has been invited to participate in a team to try to start looking into those things. One of the things that's been very high in discussion, I think, in the legislature has to do with the prescription drug monitoring program. And I think one of the major hurdles will be access to those data, because that's a lot of information about prescribing comes from that. I think it's going to be difficult for the health district to get data from that because it often would involve individual providers' names and that sort of thing, and there's a lot of sensitivity about that. But our chronic disease prevention and health promotion department or program will be involved in this as well and looking for any opportunities that we can. I think a lot of it will be education and awareness campaigns and that sort of thing. Those are certainly things that the health district can do. We'll analyze as much data as we get our hands on, but it may be kind of tricky other than looking at the outcomes, which are, you know, by the time you have a death or an overdose, it's too late. So we'd like to figure out whatever we can to get data that would help with risk factors and that sort of thing. But it's still early stages. As Dr. Zhang mentioned, we have some of the data about the outcomes, but we still need to figure out how to analyze the rest of the situation. But we will work on it.
I can understand blinding the information regarding specific patients, but why is the information blinded with respect to providers?
I don't really know if it is or what it is. I just think that the whole use of the prescription drug monitoring program is still fairly new. A lot of prescribers aren't enrolled yet. You know, they're being required to enroll and required to participate, but how that's going to roll out is really remains to be seen still.
Has that changed in the last couple of years? Because I used to be able to, haven't had to do it for a little while, but I could just fax or call a number and they'd send me a list of the patient and the doctor, how many pills were prescribed. I got a whole rundown on a patient.
The program is still present and robust and working well. One of the issues for our state legislature was requiring a pharmacy query before prescribing any narcotic analgesic. There was a lot of pushback from the medical community that this would be problematic in managing short-term pain. ERs and urgent cares and providers that give just a few numbers of pain pills for acute pain would be obligated to do a pharmacy query, and it would increase the regulatory burden for those practitioners. But the chronic prescription problem
is the issue.
Non-terminal disease is the main issue.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
With the other assessment for guys like me, that'd be a royal pain in the fanny. For small, you know, doses. And
there are two other things going on. One is, as you know, we're now part of the largest 28 coalition of big city or big county health coalition. And this has been a priority of theirs when they were down at 20 for a number of years. We have been involved in trying to see what we can do. There was a law that actually the governor's office was in support of, and Dr. Green and I both testified on behalf of it, which does deal somewhat with that issue, and it's to allow naloxone, which is an antagonist to opioid either opioid medications or other opioids, that if someone was in an overdose, you could just give it to them. If it were me, since I don't take any of them, nothing would happen to me. But if I were in overdose, I'd quit breathing. It would reverse that almost immediately. And it was an idea to save lives. And I'm not sure, I don't see it on our legislative agenda, so I'll ask Jennifer to follow up on that. I haven't heard what's been happening. The Medical Association was in opposition to it because it required every provider every time when they renewed a prescription to query it. But I believe that there was going to be an adjustment so that at the beginning of someone who would be taking an opioid analgesic, that they would have to query once and then maybe once a year rather than every time they have to renew it. So there were some of those negotiations going on. I don't remember how that's ended up.
Follow up? Yes. Thank you. For us lay people, what's an example of opioid analgesic?
Oh, gosh.
Hydrocodone, oxycodone.
Tramadol.
Okay, so it's the oxys and a lot.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
First off. Secondly, I think, Dr. Nemec, you're absolutely correct, because I remember we directed in the 90s that the pharmacy board had to create that program so we knew if people were abusing their – but it was voluntary, so maybe that's the key piece that's being changed now. Is that what you're saying?
I think so, yes.
Is a powerful tool.
It is. It works.
Us manage patients who are doctor shopping or going to
right.
pharmacies.
Yes.
And that was the intent of it, and looking at contraindication and things along those lines.
The problem, we still have a large amount of narcotics being prescribed for chronic pain for non-terminal patients. And the problem is there is no exit strategy for those individuals and end up being on narcotics for years or decades.
And then you have to go through the withdrawal on that part of it, because that's some of the with testimony that we got even when we were dealing with the county on medical marijuana component from patients on how do I'd rather not be doped up and addicted to pills. I'd rather be able to treat my whatever it might be that way. I guess I know that we've done some things with Metro with turning in drugs, because part of it's access in the homes too, especially for these young kids.
And thefts.
I think, is that done like twice a year still, where they can turn their meds in without getting in trouble?
I believe that Metro still does that for any medications, any not medication. Just these.
And maybe in the meantime, that besides education, that maybe we need to get the word out more often on that, because if people can get rid of all those pills that are just sitting in cabinets, their kids might not have access to them, because that's the next population that has access to them in the long run. Thank you.
I believe that we have – excuse me.
Go ahead.
I believe that we have almost regularly – pill drop-offs in the city, and don't you have it in the county also?
I know we do, but I don't know how often it is.
We have it pretty regularly.
Well, maybe we don't have it.
And we work with Metro or sometimes with the school police, and we have collected a tremendous amount of pills that have been left with us. But they have to be they have to be in the possession of Metro or the police.
Right.
With us, but as far as pickup, I think we're doing a lot of pickup in the city.
I'll have to find out on the county side, because I don't know if we do or not.
What I suggest that we do as a district is to query our jurisdictions and our police and sheriff's offices to find out where those are and put them on our website, if I can ask Jennifer to follow up with that.
Sure.
I think it's a good idea.
There's actually a collection bin in every Metro substation.
Exactly.
Yes, there is.
But that requires, I understand that. But the public doesn't know that. Even I didn't know that. So it is about getting that word out. And that would be
that.
Perfect, because then we could all link it with our websites. There's just different ways to be able to get that information that's there.
And that's perhaps we can incorporate that after the fact into the CHIP process and the strategic plan in terms of how we can help to deal with this issue besides supporting a naloxone intervention bill.
Doug?
I was going to say the same thing.
Okay.
They are available. I
thought there was a naloxone intervention bill that passed at the legislature this time.
I'm not sure what the status was.
Depenalized people possessing that.
The one that we were working on, I'm looking at Jennifer, was to legalize naloxone actually over the counter,
yes,
so that people can have it in their possession. I can tell you that in one of my counties in California, we had a program that was a syringe exchange far before this was passed 2 years ago here. And I thought I'd mentioned this before, that we actually did train users in the use of naloxone. And it's a small county. It only had a population of 200,000 people, but we saved, or our community saved, 3 or 4 lives in a year's period by having naloxone freely available. And again, you can't abuse that.
Because currently in Nevada and other major metropolitan areas, there is a epidemic of heroin addiction.
Correct.
And I think that we would be well served if we had that kind of some legislation in that form here in Nevada.
Thank you. Anyone else?
So, Dr. Zhang, Dr. Williams, thank you very much for a great presentation.
Thank you. Moving on to the next one. We're ready? Okay, that's Roman numeral 5, number 2, Southern Nevada website overview.
And I'll ask Jim Ostie to come up for this. Jim Ostie works in community health. He's does a lot of things, but he just did this presentation for, I think it was the CHA committee, and so we wanted him to come here and show you how to access this website and to find things that you may be interested in looking at. So if I may, sir, I'll turn it over to Mr. Ostie.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to present the Healthy Southern Nevada website to you today. Just want to start with an administrative oversight of the website. Dr. Iser is the sponsor of this website, and this is an attempt to get the data that you've been looking at out to our community so that they can use it. He gave the responsibility for administering the website to Dr. Luckett, who is the director of community health. And Dr. Luckett asked me to be the point of contact for this particular website, which I am very honored to be that. We have two partner groups that are working on this website with us. One is the Steering Committee for the Accreditation Process, the CHA Steering Committee that was mentioned earlier. They helped us to develop some of the specific information that will be presented in the website today. And also, we have a team of staff, including our epidemiology and informatics staff, which are providing a lot of the data that you'll be seeing today. We have a number of links for the website to find it. Simply type healthysouthernnevada.org, which will take you into the website, and then save it as one of your favorites, because you're going to find a tremendous amount of activities that you'll be able to utilize the website for. Starting with the data that we've been mentioning today, we've created a community health dashboard, and we have currently 188 indicators in that dashboard. They include health in a variety of different topic areas. And we're very excited that the data that you've been looking at is now available to the community as well. We use icons to show where we stand with the data. And you can see on this particular one that we're in the red, which means that this is a problem area for us. This one happens to be one of the slides that you saw earlier, adults with health insurance. By getting the data out, we believe that we'll be able to affect a lot of changes in our community. I heard just this morning that the dean of the new medical school got excited about the website and has been talking it up to everybody at their medical school, and I know that they'll be using this data to write grants as one way for us to improve our status with our per capita numbers that we were looking at as well. The dashboard has a variety of different indicator types. Sometimes we're looking at comparisons between the county and U.S. counties on average. Sometimes we're looking at data within year-to-year reviews. So you can see that some of these indicators are showing how the data is looking year over year. There's a tremendous opportunity for doing research. I presented this website on Friday to the schools of nursing for our schools that come in and do practicums here at the district, and they got very excited about students using the website to do their studies and using the data in their projects. In addition to data, we do have tools and resources. We can take you down to the report center, and we are collecting data both from national sources as well as local sources. And you can see that we are linking up to other data sources on an ongoing basis. Some of these are very new links. We want to have a variety of data points in the website so that people can research deeply some of the questions that are being asked. The website really is about the district and its partners. We have a number of partner agencies as well as individuals who have been supporting the website. Some of them are listed here. And if we go to the home page, you can see that Dignity Health which used to have this website in a much more limited fashion, is now partnering with us to provide additional resources for the website. We have United Way and the American Heart Association, as well as the three universities that are helping us right now. We have a monthly focus, and this month's focus is on women's health. What we do is we can collect a few of the indicators and post them in this mini dashboard. That way we can look at the data that's related to women's health. And what it will do is if we go into an indicator, not only will the indicator be populated, but we'll also have other indicators that are related to it up here on the right. So we can look at other indicators that might be of interest to us. We have promising practices. There's a database of over 2,000 best practices that has been assembled. And we have local resources that we might be able to utilize. We see this as a growing, interactive, and unique opportunity to work with the community. It's very robust. It's very user-friendly. And one of the things that we can do is we can actually create those mini dashboards as links on other people's websites. So if your agencies are interested in promoting this particular website, you can contact me and I can work with your IT department so that it will be actually posted up on your particular website, and it'll be a hot link for people to access it.
Question?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Please.
Thank you. That's a great idea. So I would definitely think we should let at least the county know about that. I just put it in my newsletter too. It's very easy to get to, and I'm non-techie, so I just sent that off to our staff. But it's very very easy to move through everything. I just had a question on what's the cost for the sponsorships that you noted down below. Is there?
We have a contract with Healthy Cities Institute out of Berkeley, California, and the University of California, Berkeley. They're charging us approximately $35,000 a year for this particular website. They provide all of the infrastructure for the website and all of the national data. And they make it very flexible for us to add data to it.
That's
on
reasonable.
A local basis.
Have you reached out to UMC? I'm just curious.
We have been working through our CHAW steering committee thus far, and we've invited UMC to be a part of that process. So we're hopeful that some of these other partners will be coming to the table real
Thank
soon.
You.
If I may, we're not charging any of our partners, right. However.
I could go on about this website for a long time. I know that you've already been
appreciate your restraint.
Given quite a bit of data this morning. Is there any questions that you might have that I can answer for you?
Thank you.
Just as an aside, these first two items under section Roman numeral 5 have been about our growing ability to collect and analyze and to share data, all part of our accreditation process, but all part of what we should be doing anyway. So we're excited about that. And let me point out that Ms. Demetria Patton is hiding back here in the corner. And as you recall, she's our accreditation coordinator and has helped us with all of these items and will continue to help us as we go through the process.
Thank you. I really think that this is critical. In my experience in government and public service has led me to believe that the most important thing that we do is getting the right information to make the right decisions and disseminating that information to the public so that they can participate in the process. And this is great for that, I think.
And we as physicians and dentists, I think, agree, if I may speak for us, that our job is to educate our patients to make the right choices on their own, but give them the right amount of information. I think this is what a health district or a health department, as you rightly point out, should be doing for its population and its elected and appointed officials in our case.
Thank you.
Could I close by saying one more thing, and that is that a lot of the data that we've had in the past is high-level data. It might be national data or state data. We've been very fortunate to start being able to add local data. And wherever possible, these indicators have census-level data, census tract-level data, or they have zip code data. So that's one of the real positive parts of this whole process. We can now drill down to various parts of the community to see what disparities exist in our community.
And please remember, it's a fairly long document, but we've included this on the portal, and I think in hard copy, if not, at least for Ms. Tarkanian, we have. You may want to read this, and it's about the journey that some jurisdictions have taken, in particular this one, from opposition to fully embracing accreditation.
Thank you, Mr. Ostey. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jim.
Our next item is Roman numeral 5, sub 3, review, discuss tuberculosis program overview.
And, sir, this is a part of our ongoing desire to give you little pieces of program information bit by bit. It's nursing services turn this month, and they have decided to focus in on tuberculosis.
Well, good morning again. I am Rick Seachey. I'm the Community Health Nurse Manager for the Immunization Program, SAPTA Program, and TB Prevention Program. To my right is Ms. Lori Hickstein, and she is our TB Community Health Nurse Supervisor. So she's where the rubber meets the road, if you will. My director, Ms. Bonnie Sorensen, instructed me to do a brief overview of our program today. The first thing I think I have to mention in any TB briefing is the difference between latent tuberculosis and active tuberculosis disease. We often hear stories, you know, someone had tuberculosis. Well, no, they probably had latent tuberculosis disease. And the biggest thing, because you can tell by the slide, active disease, you can spread it to people you love and care about, and it can be spread throughout our community, usually accompanied by symptoms such as a fever, cough, night sweat, chills, unexplained weight loss, and unexplained shortness of breath. Latent disease cannot be spread. Latent disease has no symptoms. It is important that we treat latent disease in our community because, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, approximately 4% of residents have latent tuberculosis disease. In Clark County, that's 80,000 people. Approximately 1 in 10 of those individuals will go on to develop active disease in the course of their lifetime. The Tuberculosis Prevention Program is by no means solely a Southern Nevada Health District organization. We rely on a number of different groups, both in and out of Southern Nevada Health District, our local providers, our local hospitals, state, federal assistance, indeed international assistance. Within the health district alone, we have a strong cooperation with our community health division. They conduct all of our active investigations and provide us meaningful data to conduct clinical work. Our refugee program, we see refugees in Clark County from all over the world. Approximately 52% of them get referred to the TB clinic for latent treatment. We can't get by without our local medical providers. Reporting is not an option, but our local medical community really supports the Southern Nevada Health District's TB program. They often call Lori in our clinic for treatment advice, reporting advice, anything. Very, very involved with our clinic. And, of course, with one goal, to stop TB and to have a healthy Southern Nevada for our residents and visitors. It truly is a place of collective impact on our community for the betterment. In talking about our program alone, we have 11 full-time employees in the TB clinic. We have two contract physicians, one pediatric, one adult. And we have a cooperative work agreement with Roseman University where we have the services of a clinical pharmacist. Our total budget is just under $2 million, of which approximately $340,000 comes from the federal government. That $340,000 is shared between two divisions, nursing and community health. Again, community health division does our case investigations. So closer to home, TB in Clark County. Our numbers are somewhat reflective of other metropolitan areas in the United States. Our current case rate is approximately 3.8 per 100,000 residents. That is a decrease, and it's decreased every year since I found records. In 1975, our case rates were 15.7. And through the decades, through all those organizations working together, we've reduced it to 3.8 per 100,000. Again, we have high-risk groups, foreign-born, children of foreign-born, and some people with chronic medical conditions. Diabetes is highlighted. HIV is highlighted. It has to be mentioned that also children of foreign-born parents are at higher rates of developing active TB disease.
I have a question, unless you
Absolutely.
Want to wait until afterwards. Okay, so we have Mexico, we have Philippines. How about China? Because I know that's another large foreign-born group. So you just took us. That's just a sample of what's
that is.
There.
Okay. That is particular to Clark County and. Other jurisdictions with a larger Chinese population have a higher degree. But again, any of these foreign-born communities, you know, coming, migrating to Clark County are at higher risk.
So when they, if it's children potentially of foreign-born, do you capture them at the school sites when they come in for any kind of immunizations, or how do we link this? And maybe that's further down the road.
No, I appreciate the question. Clark County School District does currently not conduct mandatory tuberculosis screening. Okay. We are working with the school district to try to do some targeted screening. And the CDC, in conjunction with the National TB Controllers Association, really advocate for that targeted approach. So, yes, we're working with CCSD. Also, we've successfully changed are going to change NAC to mandate reporting of latent disease for children 5 and under. That's a great thing for us, so we can find the adult
that linked that
them. Exactly.
Okay, great. And then I know that school trustee Chris Garvey would be very interested, so you might want to make sure that she's in that loop. She's got a medical background, so she's very passionate about the children's health, so that might give you at least to be able to go in and do some of that targeted.
Absolutely, and that's actually another highlight of that working together. This with Clark County School District, I'm working with our community health division on that.
And I think Mr. Cici would also tell you that we get people in from all continents that are populated, Antarctica, who have TB. In fact, was it 2 weeks ago we received a gentleman from East Africa
who transferred here from being cared for in another state, and he's now our responsibility, but he's from East Africa.
Actually, I made a point on that on the next slide, so you're right on target. We are a world-class destination city. So TB rates are on decline. There's always a but. But it's not reflected in all of our populations, as we discuss foreign-born, children of foreign-born, homeless, other population groups. We're not seeing the decline that we would like to see. We're seeing more difficult cases, multi-drug-resistant, extreme drug resistance, which we will also address, and those associated higher cost. So, once again, working with community health, we're hoping to take some information that you alluded to in the previous briefing, taking information and turning it into action. So, a non-medicine drug-resistant client is about 17,000. This includes both inpatient and outpatient care, so this would have impact on UMC, St. Rose. A multi-drug resistant client, that cost can increase to over six figures, 134,000. And then extreme drug resistance, you're pushing $500,000. And once again, that's not just Southern Nevada Health District cost, but that also includes inpatient, once again, UMC, our local public hospital, their cost. Those are some of our major challenges. Noncompliance. If we have a noncompliant client, we can spend 100 man hours working on something that would take one man hour. We have to involve legal, Dr. Iser, Metro. That takes away Metro from doing their primary function to enforce the treatment of someone with active disease. We have some great opportunities, however. Once again, I'm real excited about working with community health and taking some of this epi data, refining what we think we know, and making a better plan to prevent disease in our community. And we have an incredibly strong staff of people who are fantastic TB clinicians, from our doctors to our nurses. Ms. Hickstein is a former TB Nurse of the Year Award winner in the United States. So we have a fantastic staff here in Southern Nevada. Some things I'd like to see happen: billing. I think with the expansion of Medicaid that we start billing clients for treatment. I think this can be accomplished without being a burden to care or to an individual. We need to look at, once again, all these different drug regimens and how Southern Nevada can provide these treatments at the lowest cost possible. And we cannot dismiss the global threats. We are a world-class destination city, and we have people coming here from all areas. Dr. Iser alluded to, we had a client come in from one of our eastern states, and 1 month of that medicine was in the thousands of dollars. We've had clients come from China, basically on medical, looking for medical treatment. But now they're in Clark County and they have active disease. We have to treat them to protect the other 2 million residents of our county.
If I may, we were fortunate in negotiating with that other state 1 month worth of treatment after he arrived. So he should have, they should have shipped 1 month's worth of his.
It wasn't exactly 1 month. But
oh, it should have been. But
actually, one of his pills cost $35 for one pill. And he'll be on that pill, for at least 2 years, because part of his treatment, he's multi-drug resistant. It's at least 18 to 24 months of treatment, and they all require at least 4 to 5 second-line antibiotic agents and an injectable agent. He was unable to tolerate that injectable agent, so that means they either get an IM shot 5 days a week, but we've had some that are so emaciated we have to put in a peripheral line so they get it IV for 6 months. So in his case, he couldn't tolerate the injectable because it caused some hearing loss, so he will definitely need 2 months of treatment. So they had to go to even almost like a third line regime for him, and that's where that cost comes in, because one pill he'll take 7 days a week costs $35 just for one pill. So that's where you start getting into the cost. And once you go to those second line agents, you're talking more medical monitoring, more lab work, potential for more side effects. They can cause hypothyroidism. They can cause psychosis. So you have to do a lot more monitoring, which all can then become more costly. Then we have to make sure they're absorbing the medication, that they are getting better. And doing those blood tests, actually, we have to be sent out of state. You're talking maybe $2,000 to make sure that he's actually absorbing his TB medication. So the cost can become immense with those patients. And the reality is, if you're infected by that patient, you're going to get that multi-drug resistant infection. And as a contact, we may not be able to offer treatment so that you don't get sick from active disease later on. And that's kind of the concern for the future, as we start to see these more extensively drug resistant patients, that we may not have an option for the contacts. And then the immense cost that just taking care of that patient entails.
Question?
Yes.
Thank you. A couple down here, and then Dr. Nimick.
Okay, thank you. Was that a case of patient dumping across state lines?
Well,
to some extent,
supposedly he was living with a brother in the other state, and he has a brother here, so the brother sent him a bus ticket.
One way.
Okay.
It's a little bit more complex than that, though. I don't think it's patient dumping. After talking myself to the local jurisdiction.
We should be prepared for some potential of that, because they do it within the hospital scheme here as well. So the billing issue, is that then a federal thing we have to work on, or is there policies we could look at?
We're working with Dr. Green right now case came in to make sure that he can be covered under disability or Medicaid.
I was going to ask about the disability part. And then do we do testing in our jails?
Yes.
Okay. So that, and with the medical group that we have in the Clark County Jail? Okay. And then?
There's actually currently a case in the county jail that was diagnosed in the county jail.
Yeah.
And then how do you make someone take their meds? Do you quarantine them or take them in then into a
if you need to? If we need to, yes. We actually, through our legal, Dr. Iser sends a notice to the court, and a court order is
issued, then.
And that's when we have to involve Metro or the local police. But it really is, you can imagine all that time and effort really adds to cost.
And how do we protect our workers, our healthcare workers then, from the latent side?
We have our healthcare, our tuberculosis clinic is one thing, is it's a not very visible.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't look great, but it has great air exchanges. We use UV light to protect our staff. All of our staff are fitted for N95 protective masks. We have great protocols. Ms. Sorensen ensures that those are followed.
Okay, I just want to make sure, because sometimes we forget about the frontline people that are administering.
And in the new location, those same engineering mechanisms will be in that location, along with all the other policies, protocols, and personal
protection.
Excellent. Thank you.
If I may, the best primary prevention includes engineering control. So the best kind of a seatbelt you can have is one that automatically clamps you in as soon as you get into the car and you close the door. I don't think there are many of those, but that's the best kind of seatbelt. It doesn't require, it would require you to disengage it in order to get out of the seatbelt. So these engineering controls, again, are we monitor them. It's the airflow exchanges. It's the ultraviolet light, which kills the germ as it flows through, and all of the other things. Those are the things to protect our workers primarily. And in many cases, if those are running, if those are functioning normally, there would be no cases transmitted to our own staff. But then we have the extra set that Mr. Cicci just talked about.
We haven't had a conversion in 30 years of staff.
So. And we test our staff every year.
Yeah. And we know who's contagious, so we're actually safer than that unknown TB patient going to the ER. You know, we know who's supposed to have their mask on. And I think we've actually are safer, and that's what I tell the students. Don't be, because a lot of people are afraid to come to our clinic. But don't be afraid, because we do have those engineering controls, which you don't have in your hospital settings or clinic settings, and we know who needs to wear their mask. So we haven't had any conversions in over 30 years that I know of, because the nurse retired recently after 30 years in the TB clinic.
Sir, you had a question?
Yeah. You know, at Stanford, they had had a problem with the quantiferon gold assay of false positives. They had screened their employees on a yearly basis, and their positive rate went from 5% to 31%. Some of those lots also came to Las Vegas and were used by Quest for screening our own patients. Now, all of those false positives ended up buying those patients 9 months of daily isoniazid therapy with potential hepatotoxicity. What impact did that have on your own screening program of having the false positive quantiferon assays?
Well, first off, that problem was solved by QIAGEN, so we don't. It's not an ongoing problem with the testing. There's another test that we've also used from Oxford Labs, the T-spot TB. So often in the clinic, Lori's staff will do a confirmatory test before going down the road of months of therapy and treatment.
You know, and the quantiferon is still, the research is still ongoing. It's a new test. It's been used more international. So our Dr. Greenberg, our clinical director, feels that maybe that cutoff where they're considering positive needs to be looked at. You know, years ago they didn't even give us number values, and now they're finally putting a value of the nil and the, you know, and the antigen. And so a lot of the community feels that maybe that cutoff, if 0.35 is positive and today you're 0.36, they do the test 2 weeks later and it's 0.2. So you can't rely on one test. That's, you know, we use every tool that we have. And the quantiferon just indicates infection. And if that patient has no obvious risk factor, you know, like you said, it may be a false positive. So we kind of look at everything, not only just the test results, but kind of assessing the whole patient.
We also understand that, as you point out, Quest has been part of that problem in the past. And the way that we're trying to solve that is to bring that quantiferon testing in-house into our own lab so that we can strictly control the quality assurance of the after draw and the process right here. We don't have to worry about Quest. We don't have to worry about other providers doing the laboratory testing for us. We're not there yet, but we're getting there.
And I think, once again, the fact that QIAGEN has improved the QFT from those earlier tests where there were some issues with the tube and there were some false positives, that's been resolved. Yes, sir.
Yes. Are any of the medications that you distribute in your clinic from the state are associated with the $341,000 grant?
No.
Okay. Actually, the dollars we get from the state are basically for the program, mm-hmm. and not for the medications.
So what Dr. Iser did was set aside $1 million in an outbreak fund.
Mm-hmm. You did.
Right. We anticipated this.
We. set aside $1 million. And so if we do have one, you know, these particularly high cost clients, we have. But to answer your question, no, this is not from the federal government. Okay. Sir?
Just to backtrack a little, on the patient that came from North Carolina on his bus trip, did we do any notification of the other people on the bus, and have we done any subsequent follow-up with any of those?
No, it was not warranted in this particular case.
Yeah, he actually has extra pulmonary TB. He had a growth on his chest that was the tuberculosis. So it actually had no lung involvement.
Okay.
But when they cultured it, they found out it was the multi-drug-resistant type.
I'm stopping Lori because of patient confidentiality. I'm sorry to do that. Patient confidentiality, so we don't want to discuss the particulars of any one patient.
I was trying to hit her under her leg.
Well,
any other questions or comments?
So I guess all of it comes down to impact for Clark County. What do you get from this? So that's Clark County. That's Clark County if we didn't have a TB program. Based on 1975 rates, our TB, we would go from approximately, you know, 75 to 100 a year to over 300 cases a year. Again, now taking that into 2015 and beyond, how many more multi-drug resistant cases, how many more extremely drug resistant cases would that be? So we very much have a positive impact on the health of Southern Nevada. We are excited to come and do our work every day. And that would conclude my briefing. Subject to your questions, sir.
Any other questions?
I just want to just make a comment. I want to thank you very much for helping in the my questions with the Mariana Volunteer Research Program and with the tuberculosis program. I got contacted by some people in who are sort of like missionary public health people in the Mariana Islands, and the Mariana Islands right now have a huge TB epidemic going on, and they didn't know what the proper radiology equipment was, and I didn't know either, so I contacted you and got a very prompt, very excellent response, which I gave back to them, and it's now being used there, and there's a little Las Vegas connection.
Well, and by the way, they are a CDC grantee, that even though they're an independent country, they're one of the six that came to us after World War II. Yeah. So CDC should be providing them all the technical assistance.
Well, it turns out they didn't get it.
I'm glad they got to you.
They got to me instead.
Well, that piece of equipment, the forerunner to that, I've seen used in other overseas locations.
Right. Well, we talked about that. So anyway, we were able to facilitate it, and I want to thank you very, very much.
And if I may, one of the bottom lines that they have emphasized, I need to emphasize to you again, our cases are going down, the total number. The case rates are going down, but the complexity of the cases are going up, so you won't see any savings probably in the middle term, that's several years, as these costs that Ms. Hickstein has talked about will continue to rise based on the complexity of the cases that we get.
Thank you. It sounds like it's going to be a battle for many years to come. Very great presentation, and it prompted a lot of good questions today, and I think we've all been educated, so thank you for doing that.
Thank you, sir.
All right. We will move on then to the board reports. Do we have any board reports?
Actually, I have a question.
Yes.
Since we've all gotten our employee survey packets since the last board meeting, are we going to be talking about that in any kind of detail at an upcoming meeting? Because I certainly have a couple questions.
Well, yes, that comes under item 7.
What?
How's
under
that?
The CHO comments.
Okay.
How's that for quick action?
I'm impressed.
Yeah, good. Anybody else? Okay, we will move on to the chief or the health officer and staff reports, and we'll turn it to Dr. Reiser for the CHO comments.
Well, first of all, as a surprise to both the individual and to you all, I'll ask Kevin to come up to say a couple of words. He's not a shy gentleman, so I don't think he will be offended by this. I'll ask him to introduce himself and his relationship to us. Mm-hmm. How do you like that? State your full name and just give your comments about what you've been doing.
Okay. Hi. My name is Kevin Reitzel. I'm a third-year medical student over at Toro University, Nevada, and I'm one of the few medical students, I guess, in the history of SNHD, I guess, that's asked for public health.
Apparently when Dr. Sands was here, he got more because he is a DO and was on faculty. Dr. Williams and I are on faculty at Toro, and so when Kevin asked to come to us, we accepted him gratefully. Sorry.
And should I comment on what I've been doing the whole month and everything? This has been one of the coolest experiences I've ever had in my entire life. I'm very interested, actually, in specializing in preventive medicine, and it's a rather new specialty that's devoted to public health. And what Dr. Iser and everyone has graciously done is I've gone through every single aspect of SNHD, everything from the landfill to mosquito trapping to evaluating restaurants, and it's given me a very comprehensive and full picture of what SNHD does. So, and I've gone to legislative hearings as well, so it really has given me a full picture of public health. So I couldn't be more grateful. Thank you, thank you, thank you to all of you. Thank you.
He spent 2 days in family planning, 2 days in immunizations, 1 day with Ms. Hickstein and Dr. Greenberg over the TB clinic. Dr. Nakamura, I think that was just yesterday.
Yes.
He's been throughout. He spent time with Ms. Bradley and with almost everyone in the district that we could do for him. And as an addendum, we do have an agreement that we'll be starting to take internal medicine residents from UNR, from the program there. And so we're trying, I'll probably be doing is modeling their rotations after what he's been through and his self-assessment that we'll be talking about tomorrow. Tomorrow is his last day. Thank you. Do you have any questions for him?
I do.
Oh, no. I mean, yes.
So when you chose, how did you get through the you're doing an internship? Is that really the proper title, or is it more?
So for medical school curriculum, third and fourth year, you do rotations.
Okay.
Now they've been termed clerkships, and it's 1 month of internal medicine, another month of family medicine.
Gotcha.
You have electives.
Okay.
And I knew that I had a strong interest in public health. And when I asked the clinical coordinator, she said, well, you know what, no one's ever asked. But they looked up, and they found Dr. Iser's name in the database.
Great. And then hopefully UNLV School of Medicine will be the next group that we do rather than UNR.
And we have talked to Roseman, and Roseman wants to start, when it opens up, to start sending its medical students over here.
How about UMC? Do they? Well, see, they get them through a different program, don't they? So they don't
UMC, I can't remember where they, but the residents are UNR's residents.
They are
right?
The UNR kids,
so they're all UNR's residents.
So you get that capture then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck.
So I was right, he wasn't shy.
I had the opportunity to have lunch with him and Dr. Iser, and what a fine young man. We haven't scared him away yet. He was even interested in the political side of things when he met with us. And
that scares me away.
Yeah, it scares me away, too.
If we can go, maybe, Andy, do we actually have a building update, or do we just have these samples?
Just
Mr. Glass. Sorry.
Andy Glass, Director of Administration for the district. We have three things to update on. Next week, we're going to begin demolition, so you'll actually see activity on the site. Also, at the end of next week, we are taking our full architectural plans to the city for city review and approval and permitting so that we can actually start construction. And the third thing is that I brought along with me some color palettes and finish selection boards that we just received last evening. And these are the types of materials that we're going to be using. What we'll be doing is putting these on display with the staff so that everybody can take a look at them and get some type of an idea of where we should go with that. As you can see, we have wall finishes, floor finishes, carpeting versus vinyl. And are really starting to get into the project so that we can actually see things happening.
And we invite you to go up and look at those at your convenience after the meeting is over.
Excuse me, if I might ask. Could I ask, how's it going with the RDA funds?
We've submitted all the material that's been requested, and the committee at the city was going through that and is in the process of making a recommendation to the council. to the commissioners. At this point in time, we don't have a date established for when we expect to hear back, but we hope it's quickly.
Did you ask for a certain amount, or have they compared you with a certain amount? Could you let me know?
Sure. You want now?
You can do it. We're transparent.
Okay. We're expecting up to as much as $520,000 for the building. We were originally anticipating that we'd be able to receive up to $200,000 per building. And as you know, there are two actual parcels, the former Target store itself and then the shops that adjoin. Mm-hmm. We've kept those as two individual parcels so that we can receive the maximum amount. And the last time that I had talked to Shawnee, that was a possibility of up to $520,000.
And was that up front, or was that spread across 5 years?
To the best of my knowledge, it's up front.
Mm-hmm. Does it matter?
Well, sure. We'd always like to receive it as quickly
well,
as
I'm
we
just
could.
Wondering, because there was some questioning and some calls came to me, and so I just wanted to check, because maybe half of that, what they've done in another ward, was up front and the other was spread out. So that was what they were talking about. And
that would be very acceptable.
Yeah. And an economist would tell you that a dollar today is worth more than a dollar a week from today. We would like it up front if we
when
could.
When they talked with me, because it is in my district, they were talking about $100,000, and I said you needed more than that, or Chris would get mad at us. So
I could never get mad at you.
I know. Good friends. But I think it's up to at least $200,000 now, and that's what I wanted to know. And basing not just upon the health district, but, of course, economically, why we're moving in that direction, what it will do for that whole area there.
Right.
Which has been going down.
There's a lot of anticipation, not only on our part, but also the developer who bought the rest of the property and our being in there, and what is going to happen, the improvements that we'll be able to make with the money from the RDA to the exterior of the building, to improve the security of the building, as well as the aesthetics. So.
Well, at least we're in the same neighborhood. I just wanted to make sure. Thank you very much.
Sure. I can tell you that the Pizza Hut is quite excited about us coming in. They've been counting the personal pan pizzas they think they'll be able to sell.
Healthy eating for the health.
I know.
All I can say is that that's my conversation with them.
You know, I would like to add that we have our medical district, right? And we're going to have hopefully the School of Medicine there. And you look down Charleston, and what do you see? Fast food. So we're pushing getting some healthy eating places in there. But
yeah, you're right.
It is interesting. You can find a lot of doctors in those fast food places.
Wendy's and Mickey D's, right?
Yes.
Don't forget Del Taco.
And Del Taco. That's right, yeah.
Briefly, the legislative update, Jennifer just finished this yesterday. It tells you the bills. What I asked is for the bills that we have testified on and where they are in the status on the far right. So unless you have questions for you, this has been updated as of yesterday. And then I did ask her to follow up on SB 189, I think it was.
The medicine thing.
Not 189, but the naloxone bill.
The naloxone.
You had asked for the ones that fit under our priority area.
Oh, that's correct. Yeah, so that one didn't, but it came up, and so we wholeheartedly endorsed it. Thank you.
Yeah. And can I add the full list for all our activity? I will have that since we're so close to the end of the session with all the disposition of the final bills.
So if there aren't any questions, we'll move on. I'll ask Ms. Oakley to step forward.
Want an update on the survey? Hi, I'm Shirley Oakley. I'm the Human Resource Administrator. We're moving along on reviewing the results of the survey. What we've done is we've been working with the managers to develop, to roll out action plans within their individual areas. So either by program, division, location, they are developing action plans. The one question that everyone is addressing is the communication issue with senior management. And then each area is able to pick 2 to 3 more questions that they are of particular interest to their areas that they want to develop, help to develop plans for. We will be meeting again on the 16th of June for our next meeting, and I've asked at that time for them to have their team selected either by volunteers or in some of the smaller areas they're utilizing the whole departments in developing their plans and to have their the issues that they want to address identified at least at that point. And then we'll be proceeding on from there.
So after June we'll have that information back, and then what we are doing is one of our leadership, we meet as a leadership team with mostly the division directors, Shirley and Sharon and Annette, every week. Once every other month, we'll be meeting with the managers, which is one level below the division directors. And then on the alternate months, we'll go down to the supervisors. So we'll be meeting with the managers and the supervisors. And this will be part and parcel of what we do on a monthly basis, given the plans that will be brought back to us in June.
Question?
Yes.
You also have a labor management committee that works through the contract.
Sure.
How do your plans get developed in working in conjunction with them so that you make sure you cross all walks of life, so to speak?
The Joint Labor Management Committee consists of 8 members from the management side and 8 from the union side. And that's a smaller group. The management group is already involved in terms of rolling out the plans with their area. The 8 individuals on the union side have the opportunity to be involved with developing plans within that area, because either all of the employees are involved in some of the smaller areas or volunteers from all functional areas. And I've asked that they make sure all functional areas are represented. So just to make sure we had more representatives than that.
So if you're asking management to roll out plans, I would hope that you wouldn't want it just management-driven. You want it employee-with-manager-driven.
Exactly.
And that, so I think that's what you're saying, but I'm not hearing that part of it.
Yeah,
so.
That's correct. We're asking the management just to make sure they schedule the meetings, get the process started. But the individuals within each functional area should be able to develop the areas. And some have already moved forward very quickly on theirs. So the hope is that we'll get as much participation as possible from all of the employees and not just 5 or 6 people.
And then
frontline staff.
Your staff was great when I had to come down and do the death certificates. They're expensive. But they were very, very helpful, and it worked very efficiently, I have to say. That aside, I remember several years ago we were looking at whistleblower language for your employees. What do you have? Is it in contract, or are you covered under the state law, or do you know, Annette, maybe? You might want, there was a gap. I remember when we were cleaning some stuff up at the county on language, and then the health district came up, and I don't know what formal methodology you have in place if somebody wants to ever do a whistleblower complaint. And then do you have an office of diversity that deals with ADA and those types of things, or what is your process that way?
We're very small, so the human resource area would be responsible for dealing with all of those issues.
Have you ever looked at partnering, because we've redefined ours at the county, for example, so it's in HR, but we have a separate division, and they're actually doing trainings with, including commissioners. Have you ever looked at partnering or a memorandum of understanding to maybe have that assistance brought into your staff, or have a mechanism so you don't create a whole new body, but maybe do some training and then MOU to, I think years ago you had an MOU for whistleblower. I don't know if that still exists. So maybe there's some linkages that maybe you could take a look at. Because part of what I remember, and I didn't bring my notes from last time, is that it's not just managing the areas, it's how employees felt they were being treated, but making sure that it was transparent and there were processes in place for them to be able to access their support team to some extent. So those were just some points that I recall coming up. And then you're going to work on those departments that had the lower ranking of morale and so on and so forth, or is that what you're expecting the plans to address?
The plans should be addressing those. Once we get back from everyone with issues they're going to address, we'll be able to see where we are and where we perhaps have some gaps that we need to address.
And do you have ongoing training for management and supervisors? And I'm not always sure what the right title is, but do you do that within the district?
We do have some. We haven't done any in the last year, but we're looking at starting up some ongoing basis.
Right. We have an agreement with, that we can use the resources of the county.
I thought you had with OCD,
I mean,
right?
We can use those, but yeah. I mean, we've done some in-house supervisory and management training as well.
Okay, thank you.
And I would agree that we have a lot of new, well, even in some cases managers, but supervisors that we need to do continual training with. I'd agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Anybody? Okay, thank you.
And then I'll ask Ms. Rezatar under the CHO reports to come up as well and to inform you about a meeting we had yesterday and our plans.
Jackie Rezatar, Director of Environmental Health. Just want to bring you up to speed on where we're at with our pool regulations. We started in March with working with industry, breaking down the chapters to come up with a guide that is applicable to our jurisdiction. As of yesterday, we've turned our draft over to the state. The state is looking at ways that we have brought in the model aquatic health code into the law. So we've turned it over to them. We've also canceled our workshops that are ahead of us. And so we're waiting about a three-month turnaround from the state. When we get the draft back from the state, then we will implement a workshop process and bring industry back in to the game.
We thought that if you don't mind, I'll tell you what Joe said yesterday, Joe Pollack, who is the environmental health manager at the state level, and he said that he's never had a call like this from us, that he's used to us just doing our own thing and then informing them afterwards. And from Washoe County, I bring a history of wanting to be collaborative, and I think that if we can come up with a statewide series of regulations related to pools and other things, that we're in a much stronger position. And so that's the process that we're starting with Joe Pollack and with Bob Sack, who is Ms. Rezatar's counterpart up there. There will be differences because we are a resort destination, much more so than anywhere else in the state. So our finer chefs for the food code will need different things than what Elko will need. So there will be differences, but we want to start with the same baseline throughout the entire state.
Question. Thank you. I'm glad you're slowing that down, or, well, slowing it down in my term, but I'm having the state review it. But we have to have what they don't even do in Reno, let alone what we do down here. So we have to be very cognizant of that part of it. But I know I heard from the industry to have both the food and the pool going at the same time was insane. And so that will give people time to be able to truly weigh in. Where are we at then on the food safety part of it?
The food regulation is going to workshop in July.
When everybody's gone? That's fine if you start it in July, but I don't think we're under any pressure to complete it by August or something, some magic.
Right. Not under any pressure at all.
Correct.
And ma'am, based on what we worked with the state yesterday, it sounds like we're going to have the food code go through the same process. So everything is slowing down, but I just want to comment that by us working together and communicating, it may have seemed like a rush. We got a lot of work done that needed to be done, and at least we have a solid base.
You have a base, and I'm not going to argue against that at all. I mean, just I represent not only the strip, but I have a lot of off-strip small businesses, and they were not involved. And so when the workshops come, I'm working with Asian Chamber, Latin Chamber. I will make sure that they're participating, because the Restaurant Association is not the only dog in this house. And that's part of it. And I heard from NRA and the other groups is, let's do it right. The baseline gives us a place to work from, but we have to also look at the uniqueness of us.
Sure.
Yes.
And absolutely. You know what? And the artisan foods, those should still be embraced, and they can be handled very safely, but we have to be smarter about how we allow our regulation. I'm told that you don't want my salami and my chorizo to be sitting out for a certain time. It has to in order to be able for that. Anyway. So part of it is an understanding of not just how things are made, but how they're eaten, and that they can be eaten safely And you ruin the palate part if we don't, if our regulation overregulates. So those are just some things that we have to be conscious of in the long run.
We are.
And then when we do the workshops, you'll do evenings and days and let people
yes,
be, so that we can make sure that we accommodate folks.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
And I believe that ends the CHO report.
Thank you. Anyone else have questions? All right, thank you very much. Thank you, Jackie. You have the informational items before you, and then we will move to our final public comment. Anyone wishing to speak in public comment? All right. Thank you to everybody for participating today, and meeting adjourned.